Hi everyone, and welcome to this special episode of Low Season Traveller Insider Guides. I'm your host, Jed Brown, founder of Low Season Traveller, and some of you may know that we work very closely with both the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage and also My Travel Research. As a part of this relationship, we've been organising a series of tourism recovery webinars where we speak to global industry leaders from the tourism industry and seek to learn how we can come out of this current situation with more resilience. Our first keynote this week was with Dr. David Bierman, who's the world's leading authority on crisis and resilience within the tourism industry. For this podcast, I wanted to share with you all some of the Q&A session which formed part of this overall session, as I suspect many of you will have had similar questions yourselves. I hope you find this interesting, and we'll bring you the Q&A from every session as we move forward. Enjoy.
That was absolutely fantastic, David. We are running slightly over. We've been getting loads of questions, which is fantastic. So thank you so much to everybody for sending in your questions. If it's okay with you, David, let's dive straight into those questions if you're up for that. So first of all, we've got a question here. As an existing tour operator specializing in the domestic market, 12 years in business in Melbourne, how do I engage with travel agents when our prices are clearly displayed on our webpage? So with this, how do agents make money when they obviously will want to make commission? We would look non-competitive to our existing markets if you were to carte blanche raise prices, say 10%.
Well, I think if you're going to deal with, if you expect a travel agent to sell your product, you need to be able to provide them with an incentive to do so. You can't expect them to say, okay, I've marked my prices at such and such a level, but you can't have any of it if you sell my product. I think it's really important, again, in the spirit of cooperation, travel agents are part of your distribution network. If they're going to be selling your product, you have to give them an incentive. And of course, nobody can survive without money. So to me, they're doing your job. I learned one thing as a wholesaler. I've been a retail travel agent before. The fact it was my first position in my first real position in the travel industry. Travel agents depend on commission. They thrive on it. If they then charge on top of the very visibly quoted prices an extra $30 as a service fee to save the operator not paying a commission, that's going to make them look like rip-off merchants to their customers. Yep. Now, we have to be very careful about how we deal with customers. You might set a flat commission rate. If you're selling a tour and you want a travel agent to sell your tour, you have to give them a financial reason to do it.
To me,
it's obvious.
Absolutely. Another great question coming through here. Well, actually, it's more of a point. We talked about cruise there at the beginning. With regards to the cruise industry, this is from Debbie Summers. With regards to the cruise industry, surely it will be hard for the industry to comment now as there is a criminal investigation, sadly and wrongly, in Australia.
Well, the industry itself can comment. I mean, CLIA, which is Cruise Lines International Association, and I can actually tell you this quite directly. The ABC, which is the national broadcaster here in Australia, approached CLIA to comment on not the cruise ship in Australia, but the cruise ships earlier, the ones in Yokohama and Sihanoukville and Hong Kong, the Diamond Princess and all of that. And CLIA refused to comment. The guy I've learnt everything about cruising from, who is a regular guest lecturer of mine, the most wonderful trainer on cruising that I've ever met, and who knows 100 times more than I did, wanted to comment, but his organisation, his association for whom he trains for, wouldn't let him speak to the media. So I finished up speaking to the media, and in many cases, I was actually parroting that particular chap because I've heard it all from him to my students. And I think it's really important is that ducking engagement for the media is really bad. Now, sometimes an individual company, if it relates to a case that's sub judice, obviously can't comment. I fully agree. Mm-hmm. The cruise industry absolutely can. And the whole idea of CLIA is it is supposed to be an advocate for the cruise industry. just as IATA is for airlines, and just as the UN World Tourism Organization is for, you know, all sorts of business or travel agency federations, it's really important for representative organizations to speak up for their sector or their part of the industry they represent. If they're not doing it, they're not doing their job.
Yep.
Just because an interviewer is hostile, which many of them are, that's every reason why you need to be upfront. And one of the problems that I actually had in dealing with cruise-related issues is that I was stupid enough to do a tabloid interview with an interview with a tabloid TV program here in Australia about the Ruby Princess in Sydney, which is which I didn't mention. What they did at the end of the report is we invited everybody from the cruise industry, including the representatives of the cruise industry, to talk to us. They refused to speak to us. What does that say? It makes them look terrible. Yeah. What have they got to hide? And that's what the punters think out there. And it's really important to make sure that you have a voice and give your case.
Yeah, it was interesting. Actually, I noticed that, you know, a lot of the cruise industry have been coming out quite bullish in this, saying, you know, our bookings are up for next year and, you know, there's no problems. And I don't know if that's particularly helpful either, because, you know, no one's doing well out of this. And to come out and say, you know, of all the industries, cruise, you know, we're actually seeing, you know, massive increases next year. And I suspect, I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but I suspect that a lot of that is, you know, these cruise vouchers for forward bookings are just being used to book for next year. So yeah, of course, next year's looking up, but this year's probably a write-off.
Well, as you know, in the cruise industry, of course, although the average age of cruise passengers have gone down a lot, there's still a pretty huge cohort of people who are in the over 65, of which I happen to be a member of that cohort. And in many cases, you sort of think, well, okay, if I'm going to die of a disease, let me have a lot of fun on a cruise. Because it really doesn't matter. So I think there is a large cohort of cruise passengers who would cruise no matter what happened, because they figured, what have I got to lose?
Another great question. Sorry, we've got so many questions coming through. I'm just really conscious of time. Let me just get the, that was it. Do you think virtual immersive experiences could be an alternative offer to diversify company offerings in the long run?
Yes, I do. I think they're an alternative. They're a very creative alternative now. We are living in the virtual world, and I think they could be a very good idea for the future as well. Let's be honest about this. There are some countries it's going to take a long time before we can go and visit them again. So if you can give a virtual alternative, great. And you know, you're still selling a travel product when you start thinking about it, even if it's a virtual one.
Yeah.
Nothing like the real thing, but it's still it is an alternative, and I'm sure it would be probably a lot cheaper for the consumer and could still be actually a good money spinner for the people who are providing the service. You could actually charge a decent margin.
Yeah. Like I say, right now, that's all we have. Another great question from Singapore. What is your assessment of business travel, including meetings and conferences? Do you think that it will recover much faster than leisure travel? In what ways will it be different from pre-pandemic business travel?
Okay, very, very good question. Obviously, during the coronavirus, we've found that business people are obviously, as we are right now, engaging on webinars and teleconferences and video conferences. It works pretty well. Look, we know, particularly in a lot of societies, there's nothing better than being able to press the flesh, whether we're talking about the G7, the G20s, politicians, diplomats, business people, but we are finding that a lot of businesses have learnt to live with the online environment. So I suspect that business travel is actually going to work very hard to encourage people to do business the way they used to. We've had this extended period of people doing business online, doing education online. I never thought in my wildest nightmares I'd be doing all of my lectures on Zoom. But I think it's going to be a challenge. So those companies that specialise in the business travel market are going to have to actually present a case why it is better to do this in person than it is to do it virtually, because we've now had people, businesses who are going to spend or who have already spent several months doing their business online. So that's a really big challenge. I don't think we can just happily assume that it's going to go back to the way it was. And plus also too, you're finding that a lot of businesses will be governed to a certain extent by the type of travel advisories they work to. That's going to be a really critical issue. So the regulatory environment actually plays a really important part in where business travel is going to be heading to. I think long term it's going to be fine, but short term it's going to be very difficult.
It's probably going to take a harder hit. I was speaking to the guys at Forward Keys, who have all of this forward-looking flight data. They've got the largest data set in terms of aviation in the world. We recorded a podcast yesterday, and Olivier Ponty from Forward Keys was highlighting that actually business travel has been the worst affected. You know, when you look at the different types of travel, in terms of the forward-looking bookings, as well as what's been going on for the past few months, business travel is the one that has seen by far the biggest losses. And therefore, he was saying, I asked him the same question, do you think business travel is going to recover at the same rate, a different rate as leisure travel and VFR? He was saying that all of the data suggests that business travel, if it is going to recover to pre-COVID levels, it's going to take a long time.
I think you're right, Jed, and I think he's also correct as well too. Look, just talking about universities, we've been basically told over the second half of the year you can't travel. Our budgets have been frozen because a lot of businesses also too have lost money through coronavirus, not just in terms of their tourism. So they're actually also being much leaner and meaner in terms of about the way they're spending their money. So travel for a lot of businesses is still seen as discretionary, especially in the current environment. So yeah, it's going to be tough for the business travel market. But I think a lot of it depends on how well you market business travel and create that value proposition for it. So that's going to be a really good marketing challenge for our friend from Singapore.
Yeah, for sure. One of the points that you raised in your presentation, you're talking about things that businesses can do. Everybody's kind of hibernating a little bit at the moment because there's no bookings really as such to be had. And we're talking about giving people their holidays now. You have to take your holiday now as a way of sort of helping to pay them, but obviously a way of sort of saving money. And that kind of struck a chord with me because a lot of industries now, everybody's doing that. So I've spoken to people who are in different industries completely and they've been furloughed or whatever else. And they're also told, you have to take your annual leave now. And in some cases that extends into, they're providing them, their employees, with some of their leave entitlement for 2021. Is that an issue with people booking vacations then in the future? Because they're not going to have the time. If they have the money and they have still got the job security and everything else, if they have the money, they might not necessarily actually have the time from their employers to take a vacation.
That's a pretty good question, actually. I must admit it wasn't something that was on my radar, but you're absolutely right. It is going to be a problem because we talk about being time poor, losing leisure. If you have to take a holiday when you can't really do anything much with it, it seems like a waste, but it's something that I think has been foisted on us. I guess there is the option of some people, particularly if they feel that they have some job security, is maybe to take some of their future leave as leave without pay, which some people might do. I think people will certainly be feeling very cloistered. And I think the natural response to that is, I've got to get away. I've got to start moving. We've really got to try and, I think as an industry, we need to inculcate that in people's minds that this is a release, even if it's going to cost you a little bit. Because my gut feeling is that we probably will find that travel is going to cost us a little bit more next year than it did this year, or than it did last year, actually.
Yeah, I think that's my feeling as well. That, you know, we're going to see, we're looking at again, you know, like everybody, I guess, on this particular webinar and yourself as well. You know, been attending a lot of different webinars on different sections. I've got a bit of an aviation background, so I've been following closely the you know, the situation in aviation. And what I found interesting was I found a report very recently by Credit Suisse, which was liquidity of a number of quite major airlines, global airlines in the world, actually including Qantas on there. And it was saying that they all had liquidity for an average of 3 months. I think Qantas was less, actually, before they're, you know, basically in massive trouble, stroke going under. And it was saying that that liquidity is on average doubled to up to 6 months if they don't pay, if they don't pay out the refunds that everybody's due for the travel, which actually hasn't happened. So the feeling seems to be in aviation terms, and it's been predicted for a few years that we're going to see a mass consolidation, and you know, airlines are absolutely going to go under as a result of this, which is going to force prices up.
No question about that, Jed. And what's interesting, I get a speaker from the Centre for Aviation coming to talk to my students every year, and he's their chief analyst. And one thing that he's always impressed on my students, on an average £2,000 or $2,000 fare, the airline takes home about £9 or $9. I mean, the margins in which airlines have been traditionally operating with are ridiculous for a business.
Yeah.
And sure, when the volumes have been up, many of them have posted quite healthy profits, but as soon as you get a situation as we're finding now, when you don't have four planes, financially they go to pieces very quickly, because hardly any airline in the world, even the most profitable ones, and you know, mentioned Qantas as one of those, they don't have enough. They don't really have enough lazy cash to sustain them for a prolonged crisis. That's something I think that every sector of the travel industry has in common.
And I was just going to say, with the airlines though, is it the case that really they've been artificially, you know, propped up for actually quite a long time? I mean, it's incredible how low the profit margins are for airlines, and yet there always seems to be more entering the fray. And you know, Boeing and Airbus have been churning out 737s and
787s. There are certain parts of their business that do well. So, for example, the most profitable part of most airline services, particularly with the big carriers, has actually been their frequent flyer programs. Yeah. And the reason for that is that most of the money that comes in to pay for all those points doesn't actually come in from flights. It comes in from banks, telcos, supermarket chains, and all the other places they get points. So that part of the business really does very well. And it's interesting whether you're talking about British Airways or you're talking about United Airlines, or whether we're talking about Qantas or Lufthansa, frequent flyer programs are huge money spinners. And that's, again, gives you that whole question about being a little bit creative in terms of how you look at sourcing your income streams.
Yeah, this actually links to, you know, we're sort of talking about, well, I think actually if Carolyn is there, Carolyn, have we got a poll actually on to ask, because we've still got a lot of attendees online. And I think that we had a poll to ask, did people think that the price of aviation and flights was going to increase? Are we able to have that poll, Carolyn? Ah, there we go.
Yes, you are.
We are. So thank you so much.
I am just about to manage that poll now for you, so it should be coming out. Oh, it's stuck.
This will be interesting, David, and we can sort of see what people think, whether they believe that the flight prices are going to go up, go down,
I'm sure our audience is pretty smart people, so we'll certainly see.
We'll take the lead from the audience. So when that comes up, audience, if you could register your vote, that would be wonderful. David, generally speaking, just while we're waiting for that to come up, do you feel that we're in a golden? There's been a lot of doom and gloom in the industry. And I'm starting to think, you know, yes, you can get carried away with the doom and gloom, or if we look at this differently, are we in a golden age right now, a golden time where, as travel companies, tourism students, whoever we are, small businesses located all over the world, we're in a golden opportunity where we can fail and fail quickly. And what I mean by that is now the time that actually you can start trying all kinds of crazy stuff that you never thought you should try before because you were scared of failure. Well, right now, nobody's booking anything around the world. You can't fail. You can't fail. There's nothing you can do to fail because we're already at, you know, a rock bottom. I laugh, you know. What an opportunity just to try stuff because, you know, you can't go wrong. What's the worst that's going to happen? No bookings coming in. Well, hey, there's no bookings coming in anyway. So is it? Are we at a golden age of liberation where we can actually just, without fear of failure, just go out there and do that stuff? Give it a try. Give it a go.
It's certainly a great opportunity for creativity and for to really try something new. We've seen it certainly in the high-tech industry, in the computer industry, that people have tried things new. And I think now tourism, the old models are really, really all under question at the moment. So I think it's really critical that we look at it as positively as we can. As I said earlier in the presentation, the word crisis means danger and opportunity. They go hand in hand. And I think those people who come up with some creative ideas, you mentioned about virtual tourism. I think that could be a really big growth industry. And ironically enough, we have fantastic technology which facilitates that. So let's use it. While we can't physically travel, we can certainly virtually travel. I think the other opportunity too will be for people who might want to make travel documentaries and other things who can get around all the restrictions. That part of the industry, which again will be providing a type of virtual tourism, could also be really thriving. Yeah. I see Michael Portillo taking lots more train trips.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are going to be taking more train trips. Just got the results of the poll in. Thank you very much, everybody, for voting. 55% believe that the prices will rise considerably. 36% will rise slightly. And there's only a handful of people that think it's going to fall slightly or fall considerably.
I think they're on the money.
I think it seems to be that general consensus that travel is going to get more expensive. And that, you know, let's remember here that we're talking about the flight side of the equation. You know, the accommodation side, you know, not necessarily. And I think maybe that's an opportunity. You know, with low seasons. You know, obviously, I'm bound to talk about low seasons, you know, having set up a company called Low Season Traveler. But is that going to be an opportunity in the future for people, if they're getting priced out during the traditional peak seasons, for them to travel during the low seasons when they can save a bit on the accommodation because they're going to have to pay more for the flights? Is that a viable option?
As an industry, we've taught people to be very price conscious for decades. In the 10 years that I was a travel agent, I think I can only remember one person who didn't come in and ask, what is the cheapest fare or what is the cheapest way I can do such and such a trip? So maybe it was just the type of market that I was actually dealing with at that particular time. But we have conditioned people over a long time to be very canny about trying to save money. I think we also have to start to teach them about getting good value for money too. It's probably something we haven't done so well as an industry, and perhaps the coronavirus situation could actually help us adjust the way that we talk about travel. So much of the media focuses on bargains, cheap deals and all these sorts of things. We really have to try and, I think, say a lot more about the value proposition of travel.
Absolutely agree.
Yeah, maybe I'm saying that because I'm a lecturer in tourism. Who knows?
There's another question that's come in there from Kevin Murphy. What comment would you have to a projection that more individual retail travel agents will need to join networks and become their own wholesalers in the future?
I think that's a very good question from Kevin. I think most travel agents have to diversify their business. I know the travel agents that have done well have usually been those who actually have a niche product which they're really good at marketing, that they're very, very good at selling. I can think of some, for example, who regular retail travel agents, but they specialise in battlefield tours, or they specialise in sport tourism, or they specialise in fine art tours, things that, that perhaps they have staff who are particularly good at dealing. So I think it's playing to your skills to a certain extent. If a travel agency has people who are great experts on a destination, they could be leading their own tours. So yeah, I think travel agents, in order to survive, probably need to do two things. If they can possibly avoid being bricks and mortars, that could be a pretty good start, because that's a very big expense for a travel agent to actually have property or to rent it or to own it. The other thing too is having a diversity of product besides just booking accommodation and tours from other products. You've got your own. Also too, you, if it is your own product, you can set the price. You have the margin. So, you know, travel agents.
Would anyone want to be a principal right now? You know, on that point with you know what Kevin's saying, I think is, you know, it's almost like, you know, travel agents, you know, doing the role of the tour operator and becoming the, you know, wholesalers in their own right. Would anybody want to be a principal right now, you know, to be the one who is responsible for pulling that package together, given that, you know, at the moment, and I don't know what it's like in Australia, you can tell us, in Europe and certainly in the UK, you know, you've got millions of people that booked for and paid, you know, their air tickets and their accommodation as part of a package for future months. And you know, legally, they're supposed to get a refund within 14 days if the travel hasn't been provided or it's had to be cancelled. And, you know, for the most part, hardly any are paying out on it, because if they did, they'd go bust.
Yeah.
So now we're getting, in the UK, we're getting, of course, all of the legal companies, the lawyers, it's like, you know, the payment protection insurance. They're all jumping on now saying, you know, hey, did you have a holiday book that's been cancelled? Have you not received your refund? We'll help you do it. And obviously they'll take a cut. Well, is that the kind of thing that's playing out in Australia as well?
It does. It's interesting. I've got a travel lawyer as my next week's guest speaker, who's one of the best in the business, and they're doing really well, by the way.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
They're probably.
Who would be a principal right now? I mean, that's got to be a risky place to be in, hey?
I would say I would be much happier being a principal in the UK than I would be in Australia.
Really?
That is because your protection, the protection policies for those businesses which actually go out of business are a hell of a lot better than they are in this part of the world.
Really?
Well, I remember the Thomas Cook collapse. I actually did a paper on the Thomas Cook collapse and compared it with the types of consumer protections, if a business does go bust, are great for the consumers. They really are. British consumers and European consumers are much better protected than our consumers here in this part of the world. It's a question of risk. I think there's always a risk. You can either wildly succeed, and you mentioned this yourself, Jed, you can wildly succeed or you can wildly fail. It depends on your appetite for risk, and quite frankly, if you think you've got a product that people will really want, then it's probably worth taking the risk, because we're in a situation at the moment where governments seem to be very nice about bailing people out if they do make mistakes. So
not going to last, though, is it? Sure.
To do this.
I sometimes wonder, though, you know, where's all this money coming from? Because there's, you're right, you know, the British government alone has been promising bailouts everywhere. I feel like we're going to be paying this for the next 20 years. I mean, is that one of the risks on this? Something we haven't really talked about is we're talking about people's businesses and everything else, but actually, you know, as a global economy, you know, how long are we going to be paying for this?
Well, I really think, Jed, our great grandchildren are going to be paying this. Won't be in our generation. It's going to be on for a long time. I mean, basically, governments have unlocked printed money like there's no tomorrow, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the British government or the American government or the French government or the Australian government. We're all printing. Everybody's giving away money that really they don't have. And someone is eventually going to be paying for it, and it will take a very long time. This is going to be a legacy that's going to last for a couple of generations, paying for coronavirus. Yeah. which is why we don't do much about it in the webinar.
Fair play. We've got another question here from Yolanda Lopez Bueno, who is in Ireland. How do you think it will affect young people, as maybe this COVID affects age groups differently? Thanks from Dublin. I suspect that what Yolanda is looking at there is, you know, will there be an ability for younger people to travel more freely than older people, do you believe? Do you believe that that could be part of the recovery, could be if you are younger and therefore, in theory, are healthier, maybe you can travel more than somebody who's over 70, for example?
It's a good question, Yolanda. Look, in terms of your medical risk from coronavirus, the younger and fitter you are, the more likely you're going to be able to breeze through this. Whether it's necessarily going to be a better time to travel is, of course, a slightly different question. I suspect certainly in the period immediately after coronavirus, it's probably going to be a little bit more expensive. And I think our poll seems to have suggested that is the case. But on the other hand, I do think that certainly younger people also will have felt the shackles a lot more, I think, than some of the older people. So I guess, and I see this with my own students who are all in their late teens and early 20s, they can't wait to travel. They can't wait to get out of the shackles. And I suspect you're probably much the same as well too. And, you know, younger people are pretty creative with travel. They manage to find ways they can pay for their trip. A lot of them do have access, of course, to working holiday visas when they come back. So chances are, I think young people will travel, and they'll probably earn the money to pay for the trip at the destination when they're able to get to them. So I think young people have definitely in with a big advantage when it comes to re-travel.
I guess we'll see we'll see an increase in digital nomads. You know, we're talking about business travel, you know, potentially being down. People aren't going to be traveling as much. We've been getting used to now for the past 2-3 months of doing business remotely. And there's, you know, there is a few of us around the world, myself included, where if I've got my laptop and I've got Wi-Fi, I can work from anywhere. So all of a sudden, you know, again, it's like we were talking about the issue about if people don't have holiday time. In theory, we can work from, you know, Thailand, Bali, Australia. You know, you guys have all got great Wi-Fi down there. Why couldn't I go down to Australia for 3 weeks with my family? You know, we can have some days free. I can work, you know, a lot during the day there as well because I've got my laptop. It's almost like a working holiday. You know, maybe that's going to be the future of travel, where there's not going to be as much pure vacation, but it'll kind of be a little bit more of a mix between business and leisure, that term which we've heard a couple of times. Maybe that's the future of it.
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, Jed, we've often found that at the moment working holiday visas are for the young, for the under 30s. There is no great reason why they shouldn't be for the under 70s.
Yeah.
There's no compelling reason why it should only be something for the young. Maybe I say that because I'm in the older age group, but really it would be fantastic if countries want to try and incentivize people to travel. That could actually be part of the incentive, that people will have the opportunity to work if they want. There are a lot of people who might be of retirement age who are really fit and who love to be able to ditch in and do something in a destination, but then are allowed to by law. And regulations really very much are the key of all this. Just a thought.
It's an interesting one. Another question here, Gary here from Bruny Island, Tasmania. Good morning, good afternoon to you, Gary. What is your opinion on discounting? Hasn't elaborated, but generally.
Look, I worked in the industry for 30 years before I started lecturing. It was sort of a matter of right that whenever we got into trouble in the travel industry, what did we do first? We discounted. I always refer to it now as the financial striptease, you know, drop your prices and expose your bottom line. This is one thing we have to try and get out of the habit, because basically every sector of the industry, we've been losing money hand over fist now for several months. we've realized that the old model of minimal margins, lots of turnover, are not very healthy in terms of business survival, and it's put us into a more difficult situation there. So I would really advise most businesses to try and avoid discounting as much as you can. If you want to incentivize people, try and find a value-added way to do it, which isn't going to cost money, but it's going to look like it costs money.
Yeah. It was interesting, actually. I was speaking to somebody recently on this is on the hotel side. And again, I don't know if any of our listeners today or participants are from the hotel side of the industry. And it was a quote which had been heard from Bill Marriott, who was saying, look, what you do in a time of crisis if you're a hotelier is you close the bottom floors of the hotel. And basically, every client that comes, they get an automatic upgrade as high as you can upgrade them, but give them an experience that's going to knock them off. So rather than discounting, just absolutely, upgrade them, give them that wow experience, which is going to send them away with nothing but positive stuff. But you're still saving on the costs by closing the lower floors. Yeah. And I thought that was an interesting take on it. So instead of discounting, it's just all about value adds, but to the extreme, give as much as you can on the value adds.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's much better to give somebody a free breakfast than it is to give them a 50% discount, because the free breakfast isn't going to cost the hotel very much. And I think Bill Marriott's absolutely right. Better to have your rooms being used than being empty.
Yeah, even if absolutely.
Again, we've got to be creative about this. I think consumers have every right to expect to get some bang for their buck, and they certainly should.
Yeah. Super. I think that's about all we've got time for. We have run over our allotted time. Is there any more questions, Carolyn? Did you get any more questions through your side that we can post to David before he goes?
Yes, we did just get one, Jed, from one of our other panelists. John Koldowski is on the call, and I think the panelist mechanism is slightly separate. So
it's going to be a hard question if it's John's question.
It is. I might just unmute John so that he can share it himself for you. So, John, would you like to? You have the floor. Oh, it's gone all shy.
He's not there. He's gone to make a brew.
I think the problem maybe he's dialing in from China. So we are the mice who are running in and out of the Great Firewall of China at the moment. So, but I think his question is one that people would be interested in. So if we do have just a few more minutes to take it, he was asking about the issue of seasonality in the aftermath of COVID-19, because we know that historically viruses are at a premium at certain times of year. So I guess what he actually said to me was there any issues with doing that? So could this be a seasonal problem? Any thoughts on likelihood? And if it is, how could we handle that?
It's a bit hard to say at the moment. I mean, usually with a flu-like virus, and we certainly had this experience with SARS, and we also had it with MERS, and we also had it with swine flu, is that the prevalence of it went down in the winter time. Now, the problem that we've got with COVID-19 is it's global. So while one part of the world, the Northern Hemisphere, is now going into summer, and logic would probably dictate that the growth of coronavirus is probably going to reduce. In the Southern Hemisphere, we're coming into winter, so that Southern Hemisphere countries may actually be worse affected by it, because flus do tend to be at their worst during winters. And of course, the outbreak in China was of course right in the middle of the northern winter. Hopefully we could actually see, and I guess the it's a difficult thing to do. I'm not a medical doctor, so I don't try and pretend to be an expert on this one, but certainly tracking SARS in particular, which was mainly a northern hemisphere, it pretty much went off the table by the middle of the northern summer, because it did happen mainly in northern Asia and Southeast Asia. So it's a good question, because the majority of cases of coronavirus are in the northern hemisphere. We sort of gave that list at the beginning. it could actually start to reduce. We certainly hope that it does, because that could also hasten the growth of travel. I mean, interestingly enough, both New Zealand and Australia have done a lot to what we call flatten the curve of coronavirus. But a lot of other Southern Hemisphere countries, and I put Indonesia, of course, in that category, are finding that coronavirus is going quite rampant in those places. So it's a good question, as always, from John. I would like to think that the onset of summer in the Northern Hemisphere will actually slow it down quite a lot. But how much and to what extent? And there's so many things we don't know about coronavirus. That's really one of the biggest problems. That doesn't just include non-medical people like me, but it includes, you know, distinguished doctors and virologists.
Good point. A point in from Kevin Murphy again. New seasonalities will need to emerge that will flatten demand into lower use periods, and those will require new approaches to those attracted to a change in seasonality from those previously preferred. If successful, this will lead to more sustainable employment and business steadying. Well, that's the point of my organisation. That's why we were set up. In the first instance, it was to combat over tourism, and the irony is, you know, this was before obviously coronavirus came on the scene, but it was all about trying to sort of flatten the demand curve and to promote the low seasons as a positive experience rather than distressed stock. And I think that this whole coronavirus situation is going to hasten that, because the flight prices are going to go up. I think that if everybody is going to be able to travel as they used to be able to travel, they're going to have to start spilling more into the lower seasons, which will spread the tourism demand, which will make it more sustainable. And I think that could be one of the positive, I guess, outturns from this situation. Any other questions? Any more questions from your side, Carolyn, that you've been getting through?
No, I think you've actually covered most of them, Jed. I think you've dealt with the one which we've had probably about five times, which is the can we have the slides?
Yeah, sorry, I was going to say that. I thought I'd said it at the beginning. Of course, we will be sharing all of the slides from David at the end of this, and we'll make sure that they're available on LinkedIn, Facebook, and all of the usual places, including the websites, My Travel Research, of course.
Hopefully, you'll be able to turn them over quicker than I was able to.
Yes, I think we've hit that problem that you have when you're doing this something like this from multiple locations, where actually the human finger is still faster than the webinar can do things. But I think it's a useful lesson on warning people how to work their builds, David. So I'd also probably, Chris is on silent and might want to come in, but I'd like to thank you for your patience with the gremlins, because they were certainly out in force today, weren't they?
It happens. You know, whenever you try a new technology and a webinar for the first time. But it was really great that we had so many people staying with us all throughout the whole session, really.
Yeah, it's been fantastic, hasn't it? We've had a lot of people in, and we've still got a lot of people online, which is great. Thank you all so much.
Can I just say thank you for the terrific questions that have come in? They've been really good. It's been really a pleasure from my point of view that you've come up with some really beautiful questions.
So there we have it. Our huge thanks again go to Dr. David Bierman of UTS, as well as our friends at the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage and My Travel Research. The full episode can be viewed online at tiny.cc/WTACH, and you can register for the future episodes, which will be running throughout May on Tuesdays and Thursdays. The second special episode in this series is with Chris Flynn, who's the President and CEO of the World Tourism Association for Culture and Heritage, in which Chris talks us through what, if anything, we've learned from previous similar crises. Until then, have a great week, stay healthy, stay safe, stay home, and don't forget to share this podcast with your friends, family, and social networks. Our content will always be free for everyone, as we believe that travel is better without the crowds.